The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
This is Patty Krumholz for the Talking Information Center, reading Diabetes Update. Today is May 20th, 2026. First article, Alcohol and Diabetes, a Risky Cocktail for Your Heart. This comes from Union Health. Mixed together, alcohol and diabetes can spell trouble. For one, alcohol can raise the risk of heart problems for people with diabetes who are already at an increased risk of heart disease. Two, alcohol can impact your blood sugar and make it difficult for you to identify when problems arise. However, if you enjoy a daily glass of red wine or the occasional cocktail, is it time to become a teetotaler? The answer is a little more nuanced. According to a study published by the Journal of the American Heart Association, people with type 2 diabetes already at high risk for cardiovascular disease who drink alcohol, even moderately, have an increased risk of high blood pressure. Uncontrolled high blood pressure can increase the likelihood of other serious health problems, including heart attack and stroke. The study examined over 10,000 U.S. adults who have type 2 diabetes already a high risk for cardiovascular disease. The research found that drinking 7 or fewer drinks per week had no effect on blood pressure, but 8 to 14 drinks per week, moderate drinking, was associated with a 79% increased odds of high blood pressure. More than 15 drinks per week, heavy drinking, was associated with a 91% increased odds of high blood pressure. This study only researched people with type 2 diabetes, so you should check with your primary care provider to see if it is safe to drink if you have type 1 diabetes. Beyond its impacts on blood pressure, alcohol can be problematic because of how it impacts blood sugar and other conditions that occur in people with type 2 diabetes. Your liver regulates blood sugar levels and filters alcohol, but it is not good at doing both at the same time. So, when faced with both tasks, the liver will choose to filter alcohol and stop working to control blood sugar levels. This can lead to hypoglycemia or low blood sugar. Alcohol can also affect how some diabetes medications work. So, if you're taking diabetes medications and drinking alcohol, you can experience extremely low blood sugar, especially if you're drinking on an empty stomach. Complicating the issue, symptoms of hypoglycemia, blurry vision, racing heart, hunger, shaking, and a foggy mind mimic those of drinking too much. You may think you're tipsy, when in fact you need treatment for low blood sugar levels. Nerve damage is also a concern for people who have diabetes and drink. Type 1 diabetes on its own can cause peripheral neuropathy, a type of nerve damage that typically affects the hands and feet, and consuming more than 8 drinks per week increases that risk even more. There's no hard and fast rule for drinking if you have diabetes. According to the American Diabetes Association, your best bet, if you enjoy the occasional drink, is to talk to your primary care provider. He or she can give you advice about what's appropriate for you. If you choose to drink, remember these amounts so you can keep tabs on how much you consume. One alcoholic beverage equals 1.5 ounces of hard liquor, that's 80 proof, or 40% alcohol, 1 5-ounce glass of wine with about 12% alcohol, 1 12-ounce beer with about a 5% alcohol content. Also, keep a close eye on your A1C and blood pressure levels. Aim to get your A1C levels under 7%. Keep your blood pressure as low as possible. Providers use the following measurements for blood pressure. Normal blood pressure equals less than 120 over 80. Elevated blood pressure equals 120 to 129 over less than 80. Stage 1 high blood pressure, 130 to 139 over 80 to 89. Stage 2 blood pressure, 140 over 90 or higher. Finally, follow your diabetes care plan. Make sure to eat a healthy diet and stay physically active, while also taking diabetes medication as prescribed and routinely checking your blood sugar levels. End of article. Next article. Berberine cinnamon green tea may mimic Ozempic's weight loss effect. This comes from Medical News. In recent years, GLP-1 medications like Ozempic and Mounjaro have helped transform the way experts treat type 2 diabetes and manage weight. However, they have also offered new insights into the power of our own gut hormones. These insights include the understanding that signals from the gut to the brain suppress the appetite and help to control blood sugar levels. This has led researchers to dive further into drug-free alternatives that may trigger the same things. Researchers from Heliopolis University in Cairo, Egypt, recently published a review of the existing evidence in the Journey Toxicology Reports, assessing how the natural hormone that is produced in the gut, called glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, might be affected by natural compounds from diet. This is the same hormone targeted by GLP-1 drugs. At this time, experts have identified no natural compounds found that can exactly replicate the effects of GLP-1 injections. However, early research suggests that certain foods and the timing of meals may be useful in regulating GLP-1 hormone activity in the body, and thus potentially rewiring hunger and satiety cues. The researchers who conducted this review noted that one of the reasons they are searching for natural alternatives to the GLP-1 injections is because of cost and accessibility. Many people who may benefit from these injections may not be able to afford them. Natural alternatives may prove to be more accessible and less expensive. Another reason this research is important is because of the potential adverse effects of the GLP-1 injections. While these injections are generally well tolerated, there are certain gastrointestinal side effects that may occur, such as vomiting, diarrhea, and nausea. These side effects may cause some people to not take the medications as described. Some people may also believe that natural remedies are better suited to a more holistic view of their health. This may mean they would be more likely to choose them over conventional medicines. The researchers also note that searching for natural alternatives to GLP-1 injections is not about giving up on medications that have been successful. Quote, it's about increasing treatment options and personalizing it to each patient's preferences and needs, end quote, the researchers wrote. The review notes that the natural compounds preliminary research is focusing on as potentially mimicking the effects of GLP-1 drugs include cinnamon, wheat, ginger, fermented green tea, and berberine. All of these compounds could modulate GLP-1 secretion and expression, research cited in the review has suggested. Mir Ali, MD, a bariatric surgeon and medical director of Memorial Care Surgical Weight Loss Center, noted that there are caveats to natural alternatives to GLP-1 injections. He told Medical News Today, quote, natural ingredients may help boost metabolism. However, it is a mild effect. These compounds should not be considered an alternative to the GLP-1 medications like Ozempic, end quote. Ali advised people to keep in mind that the naturally occurring ingredients may help with weight management to a mild degree, but only if combined with proper nutrition and exercise. There is no substitute for a healthy diet and lifestyle, whether someone is using natural ingredients or taking the GLP-1 medications. That being said, there is some evidence that certain natural substances like caffeine, green tea extract, capsaicin, found in chili peppers, and berberine may boost metabolism to an extent, Ali allowed. According to him, these natural ingredients work in different ways, quote, either by stimulating the central nervous system to boost metabolism, caffeine, promote fat burning, green tea extract, capsaicin, or activating other enzymes, berberine, end quote. Recent research has found that certain foods may have an effect on diet-induced thermogenesis, which can help boost resting metabolism. Foods that may have this effect include protein from foods such as lean meats, beans, nuts, and Greek yogurt, unrefined carbohydrates from sources such as vegetables, fruits, and whole grains, green tea, and caffeine. Speaking to MNT, Ali emphasized that this effect is minor in comparison to the GLP-1 medications, and it is important to modify your diet and lifestyle to experience consistent weight loss results. End of article. Next article, The Future of Diabetes, How AI and Glucose Monitors Could Transform Early Detection. This comes from Stanford University. Type 2 diabetes is a chronic condition that affects the way your body regulates blood sugar, glucose, which is the main source of energy for your cells. In type 2 diabetes, your body either resists the effects of insulin, a hormone that regulates the movement of sugar into your cells, or doesn't produce enough insulin to maintain normal glucose levels. As a result, glucose builds up in the bloodstream, leading to high blood sugar levels. Despite common misconceptions, type 2 diabetes isn't just about lifestyle choices or poor habits. It's a complex, multifaceted condition influenced by genetics, hormones, and various metabolic processes. In fact, the pathways leading to high blood sugar can vary significantly from person to person. Stanford Medicine's latest AI research uncovers hidden subtypes of type 2 diabetes, opening the door to personalized care. About 95% of diabetes cases are type 2, but new research from Tracy McLaughlin, MD, and her team uses AI and machine learning to challenge conventional wisdom and show there isn't just one way to develop it. Scientists have long known that different biological processes contribute to high blood sugar, which is a key indicator of diabetes. Some people develop insulin resistance, where their muscles and liver don't respond properly to insulin. Others have something called beta cell dysfunction, meaning their pancreas struggles to produce enough insulin, and some have issues with gut hormones called incretins that normally help regulate blood sugar. Traditionally, diagnosing diabetes and prediabetes has relied on measuring fasting glucose levels or the A1C test, which tracks average blood sugar over 3 months. But these conventional methods don't capture the complexity of how blood sugar rises and falls throughout the day. That's where machine learning comes in. Machine learning is a process where computers learn from data and improve their performance over time without being explicitly programmed. It involves feeding large amounts of data into algorithms that identify patterns and make predictions or decisions based on that data. By analyzing how your blood glucose goes up and down over time, McLaughlin and team, in collaboration with data scientists from Michael Snyder, PhD's lab, trained an AI model to predict which metabolic issue is most likely to lead to development of diabetes in a given individual. Using a simple test, the study found that AI could accurately detect insulin resistance 95% of the time, beta cell dysfunction 89% of the time, and incretin deficiency 88% of the time. The researchers tested their AI model using glucose data from people wearing continuous glucose monitors at home. These small wearable sensors track blood sugar levels in real time, providing a detailed picture of how glucose fluctuates throughout the day. The results were nearly as accurate as gold standard metabolic tests performed in a research clinic. With this AI-powered approach to analyzing continuous glucose monitoring data, doctors can pinpoint and even predict each patient's unique subtype of type 2 diabetes or prediabetes, paving the way for more customized treatments and personalized care. The research shows AI can transform early detection of type 2 diabetes and lead to improved health outcomes like never before. End of article. Next article, being at high altitudes could help blood sugar control. Here's why. This comes from Medical News. It is a comprehensive daily effort that combines monitoring, lifestyle adjustments, and when necessary, medication. Physical activity can be a useful strategy to manage blood glucose levels. It works by increasing insulin sensitivity, allowing cells to use available insulin to take up glucose in the bloodstream during and after activity. Similarly, some diabetes medications help to manage blood glucose levels by improving insulin sensitivity or increasing insulin production. Now, research is suggesting that another component present in the blood may also play a role in regulating blood sugar levels by acting as a glucose sponge and soaking up sugar from the bloodstream. A recent study published in Cell Metabolism reports that red blood cells can dramatically increase their uptake of glucose in low oxygen environments, which may offer a potential explanation for the reduced diabetes risk seen at high elevations. The biological mechanism behind this protective effect was unclear, but the study led by scientists from the Gladstone Institutes may offer an answer. Previous research led by the team found that mice breathing low-oxygen air had dramatically lower blood glucose levels than normal. Exploring this observation further, the researchers identified that when oxygen is scarce, red blood cells adapt by pulling more glucose out of the bloodstream. This glucose sink effect not only fuels the cell's own energy needs, but also reduces circulating blood sugar levels. Senior author of the study, Isha Jain, PhD, an associate investigator at Gladstone Institutes and an associate professor at UCSF, highlighted the findings from this study to Medical News Today. Quote, "We identified two mechanisms. First, red blood cell numbers increase in chronic hypoxia, thereby increasing total glucose consuming capacity. Second, individual RBCs from hypoxic environments take up more glucose per cell due to higher glucose transporter type 1, GLUT1, transporter levels," end quote, said Jane. Quote, "We also found that hypoxic red blood cells metabolize glucose faster to produce 2,3-diphosphoglycerate, a molecule that helps hemoglobin release oxygen to tissues," end quote, she added. The mechanism involves deoxygenated hemoglobin displacing glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase from the cell membrane, removing a break on glycolysis, end quote, the researcher detailed. In the study, the researchers exposed mice to conditions that mimicked high-altitude hypoxia. This describes when body tissues are deprived of adequate oxygen. The team observed that blood glucose levels dropped rapidly, better glucose tolerance developed, and traditional glucose-consuming tissues such as muscles, the brain, and the liver did not fully explain where the sugar was going. Using advanced imaging techniques, the researchers found that red blood cells were absorbing a significant amount of sugar from the blood circulation. Under the low oxygen conditions, the mice were not only producing more red blood cells, but each cell was absorbing more glucose than under normal oxygen levels. The researchers proposed that red blood cells support oxygen delivery while reducing blood sugar by shunting glucose into pathways that help generate molecules necessary for efficient oxygen release to tissues. Quote, "While we showed that hypoxia reversed hyperglycemia in mouse diabetes models, we do not know how these findings translate to human physiology or what duration and intensity of exposure would be needed," Jane said. "The epidemiological associations are intriguing and consistent with our findings, but many factors differ between high and low altitude populations beyond oxygen levels, including diet, activity patterns, genetics, healthcare access," she told us. For people with diabetes, considering high-altitude activities, safety should remain the primary consideration, end quote, added the study author. However, this potentially beneficial effect may not be suitable for all individuals living with diabetes. People living with type 1 diabetes are more likely to experience hypoglycemia or low blood sugar than those with type 2 diabetes. Previous research has highlighted that higher altitudes may increase the risk of hypoglycemia in those with type 1 diabetes, particularly when exercising. This is likely due to a combination of factors such as the role of red blood cells at higher altitudes, as well as a loss of counter-regulatory hormonal response in those living with type 1 diabetes. Jane noted that the study examined chronic adaptation to hypoxia in mice without diabetes medications, so it is not yet known how it could affect those living with type 1 diabetes. Quote, "People with type 1 diabetes on insulin therapy face a completely different physiological context. People with diabetes planning high-altitude activities should work closely with their healthcare providers," end quote, she told us. In addition to understanding altitude physiology, the study suggests potential therapeutic avenues for managing blood sugar levels. The scientists tested a small molecule called hypoxistat, which was recently developed in Jane's lab. This drug mimics the effects of low oxygen by altering how hemoglobin binds oxygen. By grabbing onto oxygen more tightly, it prevents it from reaching tissues. In the study, hypoxistat was able to reverse hyperglycemia, or high blood sugar levels, in mouse models of diabetes, working even better than some existing medications. When asked which populations may benefit the most from these findings, Jane commented, quote, "We would need carefully controlled human studies before recommending altitude-based or hypoxia-based therapies for specific patient populations, but the mechanisms we identified could someday inspire therapeutic strategies that do not require altitude exposure. We showed that hypoxistat, a small molecule our lab developed, reversed hyperglycemia in diabetic mice by mimicking hypoxia effects. This suggests potential pharmacological approaches without the risks of actual hypoxia exposure," end quote, she explained. Although these findings are still early and in mouse models, they raise intriguing questions about the body's response to oxygen levels and whether diabetes treatments could one day harness these mechanisms in humans. Quote, "We're not able to suggest that this work supports specific interventions like hypoxic training or hypobaric chambers at this stage. Those would require rigorous clinical trials to establish safety and efficacy," Jane said. "Our work provides a previously unrecognized mechanism linking oxygen levels to glucose homeostasis through red blood cells. The more immediate impact might be understanding glucose dynamics in people who already live at altitude or have conditions affecting RBC counts," end quote, noted the researcher. End of article. Article 5. What doctors wish patients knew about type 2 diabetes prevention. This comes from AMA Prevention and Wellness. Type 2 diabetes is striking an ever-growing number of adults, but with rising rates of childhood obesity, it has become more common among youth, too. There is good news, though. Type 2 diabetes is often preventable. In fact, many cases can be avoided by making appropriate lifestyle changes. These changes can also lower your risk for developing heart disease and other conditions. A family physician shares what to keep in mind when preventing type 2 diabetes. More than 37 million, or 1 in 10, Americans have diabetes, and about 90 to 95% of them have type 2 diabetes, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But 1 in 5 people don't know why they have diabetes. While type 2 diabetes most often develops in people over 45 years old, more and more children, teens, and young adults are also being diagnosed with it. Quote, they're two pretty different conditions. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition, so it's a condition where our immune system has attacked the cells in our pancreas that create insulin, Dr. Curley said. And so the blood no longer makes enough insulin and the body can't process glucose properly because there's not enough insulin. Type 2 diabetes is a condition when your body does not appropriately respond to your insulin and we do not process our glucose normally because we're not responding to our insulin properly, she explained. That can result in elevated blood glucose levels and other complications down the road. There's a lot of research into type 1 diabetes prevention now, so there is some emerging evidence that there may be options for prevention in the future, but we just don't know yet, Dr. Curley said, noting, the more obvious form of diabetes that has clear prevention options is type 2. Type 2 diabetes contributes to significant healthcare problems and costs in our country, said Dr. Curley. It's a devastating illness that causes heart attacks, strokes, kidney failure, amputations, and diminishes the quality of life for the many people in the U.S. who have type 2 diabetes. One of the reasons to raise awareness is that many people can reduce the likelihood that they will develop type 2 diabetes or reduce the likelihood that they'll get complications from it, she said. We want to make sure people are aware of it and know about it so that they can take actions that might be available to them to stay healthy. Type 2 diabetes risk isn't simple and straightforward, but we know that people have a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes if they have prediabetes, said Dr. Kirby. That means they already have somewhat elevated blood glucose levels, but not yet high enough to have type 2 diabetes. That's probably the single most predictive risk factor of those who could develop type 2 diabetes, she said. But prediabetes isn't the only risk factor. There are other risk factors. People who have a strong family history of type 2 diabetes are at much higher risk, as well as people who struggle with obesity, said Dr. Curley. And then, people who identify as certain races and ethnicities also have a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Not because there is anything inherent about their biology, but because of the systemic racism that has created the environments and the circumstances where people are more likely to develop type 2 diabetes, she added. Other people who are at risk include people who had gestational diabetes when they were pregnant, said Dr. Curley. People who have a history of gestational diabetes are a frequently overlooked group of people, and they're really at high risk for developing type 2 diabetes. Such patients really benefit from more frequent follow-up with their physicians, making sure they're monitoring this over the long term, she said, adding, they may benefit more from medications for prevention than some of the other people with different risk factors. This is a group that is really important for us to pay attention to, said Dr. Curley emphasized, noting it is important to keep a gestational diabetes diagnosis in mind, especially if they were being cared for by an OBGYN when they were pregnant, but their primary care physician is a different person, end quote. This is where patients and physicians should, quote, make sure that the information stays top of mind for their whole care team, and we don't forget about their history of gestational diabetes down the road, end quote, she said. There's not much good that could come out of playing the blame game regarding the role of patients' health behavior, said Dr. Curley. That having been said, quote, if a person can identify that they have prediabetes or some of those other risk factors such as obesity, then we still encourage people to examine whether there are changes that they can make that would help decrease their risk. There are oftentimes are some things that they really can't change about their lives, she said, but oftentimes there are some real positive changes that people can make. Diabetes risk is really complicated, and there's a genetic component that people have no control over, said Dr. Curley, adding that that's how people's environment influences their risk of type 2 diabetes is an area that is still only partially understood. There are plenty of factors in our environment that, as individuals, we have no control over that still influence our risk of developing type 2 diabetes, she said. So the solutions for preventing type 2 diabetes do include steps individuals can take, but it's also really important to think about things that communities and systems can change. That's because some of a person's risk really is completely out of their individual control, Dr. Curley said. One of the main reasons we're so concerned about people who get type 2 diabetes is it is a really difficult illness on your cardiovascular system, Dr. Curley said. Diabetes causes damage to your blood vessels throughout your body, within your heart, brain, legs, and kidneys. Having diabetes and having that long-term damage to your blood vessels increases that risk for heart attack and stroke, she added. Diabetes, for many people, is actually a cardiovascular disease, substantially increasing a person's risk for having a heart attack or stroke, end quote. Cardiovascular disease is the number one cause of death in people living with diabetes, resulting in two-thirds of deaths in people with type 2 diabetes. On top of that, people with diabetes are twice as likely to have heart disease or a stroke than people without diabetes, according to the American Diabetes Association. That's why it is important to keep your heart health in mind by lowering high blood pressure, addressing high cholesterol, maintaining a healthy weight, and more. Quote, in terms of individual actions that people can take, they may not be as dramatic as people think that they need to be, said Dr. Curley. For people who are struggling with obesity, they might be focused on losing 50 pounds, but losing 5 to 10 pounds could really decrease their likelihood of developing type 2 diabetes. That's another reason why talking with a physician can be really helpful, because it helps you do some goal setting and figure out what a realistic or appropriate goal is to actually reduce your risk, she added, noting, it may not be as ambitious or as intimidating as a lot of people tend to think it is. End quote, end of article. Next article, which foods help lower, manage blood sugar? This comes from Zoe. After you eat, your body breaks down digestible carbohydrates into simple sugar molecules called glucose. This happens in your gut. The glucose then moves through your gut wall into your bloodstream. Once there, it travels around your body, providing energy. At the same time, your body releases a hormone called insulin. This helps cells take up glucose, removing it from your bloodstream. So, your levels of blood glucose or blood sugar rise and fall in the first few hours after a meal. This is normal, but blood sugar responses vary between people. One person may only have a small rise in blood sugar after a meal. Someone else may have a much more pronounced blood sugar spike. Another person may have a large dip in blood sugar all after eating the same meal. Managing blood sugar levels is particularly important for people with type 1 or type 2 diabetes. People with type 2 diabetes don't produce enough insulin, or their bodies don't respond to it as well as they should. And people with type 1 diabetes produce little or no insulin. Because of this, their blood sugar levels are more prone to larger peaks and dips. This is why scientists have mostly studied ways to manage blood sugar in people with diabetes or prediabetes. Blood sugar control is important for people without diabetes too. For instance, Zoe's own research has shown that people with large dips in glucose are more likely to feel hungry soon after eating and consume more calories later in the day. If large spikes and dips occur occasionally, it's not a significant problem. But if they happen regularly, over time, it can increase your risk of cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. Some foods are more likely than others to produce a pronounced blood sugar response. These foods are called high glycemic index, GI, foods. One example of a high GI food is white rice. The carbs in white rice quickly break down in your gut, so the sugar tends to reach your bloodstream relatively fast, causing a blood sugar spike for some folks. But pairing high GI foods with other foods that contain fiber, protein, or fats can help reduce the size of your blood sugar response. So if you eat white rice with high protein beans, it's likely to cause a smaller response. Similarly, white bread can produce a large blood sugar spike in some people, but pairing it with peanut butter can reduce the response. This is because peanut butter is rich in protein, fiber, and healthy fats. Generally, people have better blood sugar control in the morning than the evening, so a high-carb meal for breakfast is likely to produce a smaller response than an identical meal later in the day. There's evidence that the order in which you eat your food matters too. For instance, eating foods rich in protein or fat before you eat carbs reduces your blood sugar response. For more details, we have a podcast that covers food ordering and other ways to reduce your blood sugar responses. To be clear, no single food on its own can quickly reduce your levels of blood sugar. But adding certain types of foods to a meal can help reduce your blood sugar responses after you eat. We look at these foods below. Studies have shown that protein-rich legumes can help reduce your blood sugar response to meals you eat later in the day. There's also evidence that following a low GI diet rich in legumes may reduce blood sugar levels for people with type 2 diabetes and improve blood sugar control. Aside from their effect on blood sugar, legumes are nutrient-dense and often relatively low-cost. Some examples of legumes are chickpeas, lentils, peanuts, peas, black beans, pinto beans, green beans, lima beans, and soybeans. Like legumes, nuts are rich in protein. They're also rich in healthy fats. Both of these components may help manage your blood sugar response to food. For example, one study found that eating nuts reduced blood sugar responses after the participants ate a slice of white bread. The study included people with and without type 2 diabetes. And according to a 2014 review, consuming nuts is associated with lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Quick tip, if you choose nut butter rather than whole nuts, go for options with the fewest ingredients. Some nut butters have added sugars, which could affect your blood sugar responses. Add crunchy peanut butter is generally better than smooth. Vegetables are a great source of fiber, and studies have shown that consuming fiber reduces your blood sugar response after a meal. There's also some evidence that eating leafy green vegetables is linked to a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Some high-fiber veggies include carrots, broccoli, cauliflower, eggplants, and Brussels sprouts. At Zoe, we know that having a diverse range of vegetables and other plants in your diet is best for your long-term health, but we also know that everyone responds differently to food. Seeds are packed with fiber, protein, and healthy fats. So, adding seeds to your meals may help reduce your blood sugar responses. For instance, a clinical trial showed that adding 65 grams of pumpkin seeds to a meal significantly reduced the participants' blood sugar responses. But 65 grams is a fairly large serving of seeds. Another study found that 25 grams of chia seeds or 31.5 grams of flax seeds reduced participants' blood sugar responses after they ate a high sugar snack. Here are some good seeds to add to your diet. Chia seeds, pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, flax seeds, sesame seeds. Some fruits, like bananas, can cause blood sugar spikes for some people, but other fruits may help reduce blood sugar responses after a meal. For instance, one study tested the effects of red raspberries in people with prediabetes. They found that these berries reduced participants' blood sugar responses when they were part of a high-carb breakfast. Another study looked at the effects of blackberries in men with overweight or obesity. The participants added 600 grams of blackberries every day to a high-fat diet. After 7 days, their blood sugar levels improved compared with their levels after eating a high-fat diet that didn't include blackberries. Still, adding that many blackberries to your diet every day would probably get expensive. But overall, eating more whole fruits is associated with a reduced risk of diabetes. Importantly, though, consuming fruit juice is linked to an increased risk of diabetes. Some high-fiber fruits include avocados, apples, strawberries, pears, raspberries, blackberries, and kiwis. Your body quickly digests highly refined grains like white flour and white rice. These can cause blood sugar spikes in some people. But whole grains are fiber-rich, so they can help reduce your blood sugar responses after eating. One review investigated the effects of oats in people with type 2 diabetes. The scientists concluded that adding oats to participants' diets improved their blood sugar control. Also, regularly eating whole grains is associated with a reduced risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Alongside fiber, whole grains contain a wide range of healthy components, like vitamins, minerals, and healthy fats. Some grains you might add to your diet include barley, bulgur, farro, millet, dark rye flour, whole wheat flour, wheat germ, quinoa, brown rice, wild rice, and popcorn. End of article. Next article. High-fat, low-carb diet lowers blood sugar, improves exercise response in mice. From Medical News. The authors of this study explain that chronic high blood sugar can affect proper adaptation to aerobic exercise. People with high blood sugar may struggle to make improvements in peak oxygen consumption rate, which has to do with the highest level of oxygen the body can use in high-intensity exercise. Previous research from this group had shown that high blood sugar in mice impairs aerobic adaptation. They wanted to see if the ketogenic diet could help restore this in mice that underwent exercise training. The ketogenic diet involves consuming higher amounts of fat and lower amounts of carbohydrates. To test their ideas, they worked with mice with induced high blood sugar and control mice. Some high blood sugar mice received a ketogenic diet, while others received a normal diet. The non-high blood sugar controls also received a regular diet. The researchers monitored the mice's weight and blood sugar levels. some mice underwent exercise while others remained sedentary. Researchers further tested how switching back to a regular diet following the ketogenic diet affected outcomes. They also had some sedentary mice complete one exercise bout. Researchers evaluated the mice after the exercise training period, assessing factors such as blood sugar, maximum exercise capacity, and body composition. Researchers found that mice with high blood sugar on the ketogenic diet had normal blood sugar levels compared to mice with high blood sugar levels on the normal diet, which was high in carbohydrates. Mice with high blood sugar on the ketogenic diet also had blood ketones, indicating the use of fat as an energy source. Regarding exercise training, all mice, regardless of diet or blood sugar levels, experienced benefits such as improved lean mass and lower random blood sugar levels. The sedentary mice on the ketogenic diet gained fat mass and weight. For the mice who underwent exercise training and were on the ketogenic diet appeared to cancel out the problems with peak oxygen consumption. In contrast, the high blood sugar mice doing exercise training and on a normal diet experienced blunted improvements in peak oxygen consumption. Problems with skeletal muscle remodeling that occurred in the normal diet and high blood sugar mice that were exercising were not observed in the exercise training mice on the ketogenic diet. The authors note that this fix in skeletal muscle remodeling could be why there were the observed improvements in peak oxygen consumption. Further research also suggested that ketones may help with this muscle remodeling. However, exercise performance was about the same for these groups. One possible reason is that the ketogenic group had lower levels of glycogen, which is how the body stores carbohydrates. Mice on the ketogenic diet had higher rates of fatty acid oxidation, which aids in fatty acid breakdown. In the exercising mice on the ketogenic diet, there also appeared to be greater levels of oxygen use, quote, during the first 10 minutes of maximal exercise testing, end quote. The results suggest that the change in peak oxygen consumption from the keto diet and exercise training is separate from fatty acid oxidation rates. Sedentary ketogenic diet mice also had higher levels of oxygen use and fatty acid oxidation rates during moderate exercise compared to mice on normal diets. They also had altered levels of certain substances like lactate. In skeletal muscles of mice on the ketogenic diet, glucose metabolism and transport were downregulated, while fatty acid metabolism and transport were upregulated. The authors also observed changes in the skeletal muscles that they believe indicate the muscles adapt in many ways to a ketogenic diet. These changes may be the underlying reason they also observed increased fatty acid oxidation. They also observed changes in muscle mitochondria, the cells that create energy, and changes in regulators of blood vessel growth. Researchers followed up by seeing how the ketogenic diet and exercise affect mice with normal blood sugar levels. One notable finding was that the ketogenic diet did help improve peak oxygen consumption rate in sedentary, but not in exercise training mice. In these mice, researchers found that switching back and forth to carbohydrates for 1 week from the ketogenic diet enhanced exercise performance, helping to mitigate, quote, the disconnect between VO2 peak and exercise performance in keto-fed mice, end quote. Study author Sarah Lessard, PhD, Associate Professor, Fralin Biomedical Research Institute, Center for Exercise Medicine Research, explained the following to Medical News Today, quote, when combined with exercise training, a keto diet can improve the health benefits gained from exercise in mice. Specifically, mice with hyperglycemia that consumed a ketogenic diet had bigger improvements in aerobic exercise capacity, a measure of the body's ability to use oxygen, than mice consuming a regular diet with high carbohydrate content. We think the exercise improvements with a ketogenic diet are due to the blood glucose-lowering properties of the diet, as high blood glucose appears to block some of the positive effects of exercise, end quote, she said. The major limitation of this study is the use of animals, specifically male mice, which doesn't directly translate to work with people. Researchers also used cell research, which also doesn't directly apply to people. High blood sugar was also something induced in mice in this study, so it's certainly not the same as how diabetes develops in people. The ketogenic diet in mice was also different from what it may look like in people. The authors further note that they did not measure how mice's diets affected fasting ketone levels or post-glucose load insulin levels, which could have provided useful information. Caloric intake tended to be higher in the mice on the ketogenic diet, though exercise appeared to offset this. It is also possible that fat mass could have impacted the results of the peak oxygen consumption. Future research can explore the effects of the ketogenic diet along with exercise in people with high blood sugar and confirm underlying mechanisms. While this study was only conducted in mice and indicates the need for more research, it does suggest possible benefits in people with diabetes from following a ketogenic diet and exercising. Lessard noted the following to Medical News Today, quote, "People with high blood sugar due to diabetes or insulin resistance may not gain the same health benefits from exercise as those with normal blood sugar levels. Our work shows that diets or other treatments that can lower blood sugar in those with hyperglycemia may help to enhance the response to exercise training, leading to improved aerobic exercise capacity. This is important because low aerobic exercise capacity is a strong risk factor for chronic disease and mortality," end quote, Lessard said. However, caution may be warranted regarding the ketogenic diet. Karen Z. Berg, MSRD CDN, who was not involved in the study, explained the following, quote, "A ketogenic diet is a diet that is high in both protein and fat, and it avoids or limits carbohydrates. Unfortunately, many people who have hyperglycemia or type 2 diabetes also suffer from other comorbidities that would not benefit at all from a keto diet. Oftentimes, type 2 diabetes is accompanied by obesity and or heart disease. A high-fat diet is the opposite of what these individuals need," end quote. That being said, the ketogenic diet may work for some individuals. Kristen Kirkpatrick, MSRDN, who was also not involved in the study, noted the following, quote, "We always have to interpret keto research in real-world context. In my clinical practice, I've seen meaningful benefits with both ketogenic and lower carbohydrate approaches, with lower carb generally around 25% of total calories. But one of the biggest questions with a ketogenic diet is sustainability. The long-term success of any dietary pattern ultimately depends on whether someone can realistically maintain it over time." End quote. End of article. Article 8, Alcohol and Diabetes, from the American Diabetes Association. If you never or rarely drink alcohol, you're not alone. In fact, people with diabetes drink about half as much as other adults. Why? Maybe their doctors caution them that drinking and diabetes don't mix. Perhaps some have health conditions that are incompatible with alcohol. Or maybe they're just concerned about all those calories and carbs. But is the occasional cocktail or glass of wine really so bad? After all, a daily drink does have its benefits. Still, diabetes can make happy hour pretty confusing. Here's what you need to know about drinking and how to do it safely. You've probably heard that alcohol is good for your heart, but that's an oversimplification. Take a look at the numbers and you'll find that only moderate drinkers have less cardiovascular disease. Those on the opposite ends of the spectrum, people that drink heavily and those that don't, have a greater risk. But what exactly is moderate drinking? It's one drink a day for women and up to two per day for men. However, that drink is a lot smaller than some people think. Just 5 ounces of wine, a 12-ounce beer, or 1.5 ounces of 80-proof spirits. A daily cocktail or two may improve blood glucose management and insulin sensitivity. If you have one or more drinks a day, you may find that your A1C is lower than during times you weren't drinking. But if you don't drink regularly, this doesn't mean you should start. After all, other aspects of moderate drinkers' lives may be behind the link. Too much drinking, on the other hand, more than 3 drinks daily, can lead to higher blood glucose and A1C. Despite the potential health perks of drinking alcohol, there are some cautions as well. The biggest concern is hypoglycemia, low blood glucose. When drinking alcohol is combined with the medications most often used to treat diabetes, particularly insulin and sulfonylureas, a low blood glucose can result. While a glass of wine with dinner probably isn't a big deal, a mojito on an empty stomach at happy hour is. Blame it on your liver. This organ stabilizes glucose levels by storing carbohydrates and releasing them into the bloodstream between meals and overnight. It's also the body's detoxification center, breaking down toxins like alcohol so the kidneys can easily flush them away. Trouble is, it's not great at multitasking. Your liver will choose to metabolize the alcohol over maintaining your blood glucose, which can lead to hypoglycemia. The liver often makes this choice when you drink without eating food, so consider snacking while you sip. Because many of the symptoms of hypoglycemia, such as slurred speech, drowsiness, confusion, or difficulty walking, are also symptoms of being drunk, it can be difficult to tell the two apart. And if you often have hypoglycemia unawareness, a condition in which you don't recognize you're going low, drinking becomes especially dicey. Timing may also be an issue, as hypoglycemia can strike hours after your last drink, especially if you've been exercising. There's another reason drinking can be challenging. Unlike protein, fat, or carbohydrate, alcohol doesn't require insulin to provide energy to the body. Yet many people assume that alcoholic drinks are loaded with carbs, not realizing that wine and spirits are practically carbohydrate-free, with only a trace of carbohydrate in spirits and roughly 4 grams of carbs in a 5-ounce glass of wine. The exception is sweet dessert wines, which pack 14 grams of carb in a tiny 3.5-ounce glass. High-carb drinks may sound like the smart option when you're at risk for hypoglycemia, but it's a bit more complicated than that. Liquid sugars are quickly absorbed by the body, so those carbs won't be much help in preventing or treating a low that may occur hours after you drink. Food, on the other hand, is digested gradually, so it provides better protection against lows. With all the focus on carbs, it's easy to forget that alcohol also has calories. Given that drinking can make you lose track of what you're eating, calories and pounds can add up quickly. Being tipsy has another downside, making it easy to mix up your medications or to forget to take them entirely. Remember, drink sizes vary. They can make it especially difficult to get a grip on how many carbs and calories you're consuming. Drinking is individualized, and there's no universal rule for how to do it safely when you live with diabetes. Talk to your doctor about your drinking habits, and they can provide you with tips and tricks for how to drink in a way that works for you. End of article. Next article. Keto may work best for sending diabetes into remission. Here's why. From Medical News. Now, a new study published in the Journal of the Endocrine Society has found that people with type 2 diabetes following the keto diet, which is high fat and low carb, may have a better chance of reversing their diabetes than those following a low-fat diet. For this study, researchers recruited 51 adults between the ages of 55 and 62 with type 2 diabetes. Participants followed either the keto diet or low-fat diet for 12 weeks. Quote, carbohydrate-restricted diets have been shown to elicit several beneficial effects in patients with type 2 diabetes, including lowering HbA1c, systolic blood pressure, and triglycerides. End quote. Marion Yurchison, MS, pre-doctoral training fellow at the Department of Nutrition Sciences at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and lead author of this study, told Medical News Today. Quote, by identifying its therapeutic effects, we want to show that a ketogenic diet could serve as a complementary aspect of lifestyle therapy, which could contribute to better glycemic control as a result of improved beta cell function, Yurchison explained. Other than bariatric surgery or large volume intentional weight loss, interventions for improving beta cell function in type 2 diabetes, particularly in the absence of weight loss, do not currently exist. Further, these therapies may not be feasible or sustainable for most individuals. While the potential to restore beta cell function is possible in early disease states, effective therapies and useful markers for gauging effectiveness of treatment are not known, end quote. At the study's conclusion, researchers found that while study participants both lost weight following either the keto or low-fat diet, those following keto experienced a decrease in the proportion of proinsulin secreted to a greater extent, a change that was associated with an improvement in beta cell function. Quote, the pancreas has to go through several steps to make insulin, Yurchison explained. When beta cells are under significant stress, as seen in type 2 diabetes, they secrete a lot of proinsulin. Proinsulin is a precursor to insulin, so elevated proinsulin levels indicate that beta cells are overwhelmed and secreting unfinished molecules as an attempt to keep up with the body's increasing demands for insulin, she continued. A larger decrease in proinsulin suggests that the ketogenic diet reduced this stress and allowed beta cells to work more efficiently, as evidenced by the improvements in beta cell function, end quote. What might it be about the keto diet that would allow it to help improve beta cell function? Quote, one process that may contribute to beta cell failure is their loss of glucose sensing and glucose responsiveness, which is thought to result from the beta cell's chronic exposure to glucose, glucose toxicity, Yurchison told us. Removal of this exposure via a carbohydrate-restricted diet may therefore provide an environment for beta cells to repair their secretory systems, but more research is needed to identify the specific mechanisms behind this effect, she noted. As beta cells are responsible for secreting insulin in response to increases in blood glucose, restoration of their function allows these cells to produce adequate insulin to sustain adequate blood sugar levels, end quote, she added. MNT had the opportunity to speak with Pooya Shafipur, MD, a board-certified family and obesity medicine physician at Providence St. John's Health Center in Santa Monica, California, about this study, who commented he was not surprised by its findings. Quote, "For early cases of diabetes, keto can do miracles if people adhere to it well, and if they're doing Mediterranean higher fiber keto," Shafipur, who was not involved in this research, said. "But the biggest challenge with keto is that a lot of people do carnivore keto. They don't necessarily eat the right type of fat and protein and also adhere to it. This study is 12 weeks, and in 12 weeks, it's easier to adhere to it," he pointed out. According to him, another big challenge is that people go on keto for 2-3 months, get results, and then start getting bored of it. We're living in a world that just flooded with carbohydrates, and once you get out of it, it's hard to get back into a ketogenic state. It requires a lot of discipline, a lot of saying no to a lot of temptations. So keto is fantastic and miraculous, it's just that adherence is a little bit challenging," end quote, said Shafipur. For the next steps in this research, Shafipur told us he would like to see a bit longer study duration and what type of specific keto diet participants are following. Quote, "Because keto to one person might mean just like the old school Atkins diet, that you're eating a lot of bacon and cheese," he explained. "But now we found out that those inflammatory fats are not necessarily healthy, even though they cause weight loss, but they can increase tumor markers and inflammatory markers in the blood. With longer study adherence, you follow patients 6 months to a year to see how much they can adhere, and then you measure their C-peptides, A1C, and pancreatic cell function. We want to make sure with diabetes management, we're not just managing the blood sugar, but we're preserving pancreatic cell function and we're actually reducing the IL-6, the TNF-alpha, all these inflammatory markers that are in the background destroying the body in a diabetic person," end quote. For those who may want to give following the keto diet a shot, Monique Richard, MSRDN, LDN, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and owner of Nutrition Insight, offered some expert tips. Quote, "It is most important to prioritize a way to look beyond initial outcomes and consider sustainability, access, nutritional adequacy, and impact on overall health, especially cardiovascular health, which is closely tied to or increased in those with type 2 diabetes," Richard said. "The research established so far conveys that while low-carb and ketogenic diets may improve glycemic control in the short term, they may not be consistently superior over time compared to other balanced dietary patterns, or not without their own side effects and shortfalls, that is, gallbladder health, arterial inflammation, impact on liver function," end quote, she advised. While lowering carbs can help blood sugar levels, Richard said that how this is done and what they are replaced with matters just as much, if not more. Some general recommendations for those interested in exploring the keto diet include focusing on food quality, not just macros. Not all keto diets are created equal, Richard said. Replacing carbohydrates with highly processed meats, ultra-processed foods marketed as keto-friendly, and saturated fats may negatively impact heart health, while emphasizing unsaturated fats, olive oil, nuts, seeds, avocado, and non-starchy vegetables supports better outcomes. Be strategic and mindful. It's not about restriction elimination or excess of one or more particular food groups or macros. Consider moderate carbohydrate reduction rather than extreme restriction. Even decreasing the frequency of refined carbohydrates or portions consumed, in addition to the amount of added sugars, can significantly improve glycemic control, Richard said. Keep the variety, hold the towering fat and protein stack. A double bacon cheeseburger with extra bacon sans the bun is a lot for the digestive system to process, in addition to the excess sodium, preservatives, and lack of beneficial nutrients this combo contains, Richards explained. Restrictive and imbalanced diets can limit fiber, phytonutrients, and gut microbiome diversity, which are all important for metabolic health. Quote, "The best nutrition plan is the one that works for your biology and your life," Richard added. As with most things in nutrition, there is no one-size-fits-all approach. The goal isn't just to lower blood sugar, it's also to support long-term health, quality of life, and sustainable habits. If someone is considering a ketogenic approach, I always emphasize doing so with guidance from a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and healthcare team, especially because medications often need to be adjusted, end quote, she advised. End of article. And from the summer 2026 edition of Diabetes Self-Management, Kidney Protection Compared by Diane Fennell. Kidney disease is one of the most serious long-term complications of diabetes. Identifying treatments that could prevent damage before it begins is a major goal in diabetes care. two medication families, SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists, have become central treatments for type 2 diabetes. Both can lower blood glucose and reduce complications, but researchers have lacked direct comparisons of how they affect kidney health. To address this gap, investigators analyzed nationwide health records in Denmark, compared adults with type 2 diabetes who started the following. SGLT2 inhibitors such as empagliflozin or dapagliflozin, or GLP-1 receptor agonists such as liraglutide, semaglutide, or dulaglutide. Participants were followed for up to 5 years to track chronic kidney disease, CKD, acute kidney injury, AKI, and related outcomes. The findings were published in JAMA Internal Medicine. The study included 36,279 people who started an SGLT2 inhibitor, 18,782 people who started a GLP-1 receptor agonist. People taking SGLT2 inhibitors had 19% lower risk of chronic kidney disease, fewer acute kidney injury events, less sustained decline in kidney filtration, eGFR. Their protective effect was most noticeable in individuals who did not already have kidney disease. However, the results were not entirely one-sided. Participants on SGLT2 inhibitors showed a slightly higher risk of new or worsening albuminuria, protein in the urine, another marker of kidney health. Researchers suggested the difference may reflect distinct effects of the two drug classes on different markers of kidney health. The researchers concluded that SGLT2 inhibitors may offer particular value for early kidney protection, especially in people without existing kidney disease, though future studies should explore whether combining therapies could provide additional benefits. They emphasized that treatment decisions still depend on the individual patient's risks, goals, and other conditions, especially since one analysis found a 24% higher risk of death with SGLT2 inhibitors compared with GLP-1s, a signal commentators described as worrisome and in need of further study. Commenting on the study, nephrology and endocrinology specialists noted the findings add useful information but should not dramatically change clinical practice. There were a variety of limitations to the study. For instance, the research was observational rather than randomized, meaning it can show associations but cannot prove that one treatment directly caused the differences seen. The researchers also had limited information about participants' body weight and body composition, which could influence both medication choice and kidney outcome. In addition, the data came from a single national population, so the findings may not apply equally to all groups worldwide. Because of these factors, the results should be interpreted cautiously and do not establish one medication class as definitively superior. Until randomized trials directly compare the medications, clinicians should continue using clinical judgment when choosing therapy. End of article. Next, daylight improves blood sugar, by Diane Fennell. Our internal clocks don't just regulate sleep, they also play an important role in metabolism and blood sugar management. A new study published in Cell Metabolism suggests that natural daylight, even through a window, may help people with type 2 diabetes spend more time in a healthy glucose range. Researchers from Maastricht University conducted a randomized crossover trial involving 13 adults with type 2 diabetes, average age 70. Each participant spent 4.5 days in two conditions, one with natural daylight through large windows and one with typical indoor artificial lighting. During both periods, participants followed the same schedules, meals, medications, and light exercise routines. Glucose levels were continuously monitored. While average glucose levels did not differ significantly, participants exposed to natural daylight spent more time in the target range, 4.4 to 7.2 ml per liter, 79.2 to 129.6 milligrams per deciliter, 51% of the time compared with 43% under artificial lighting, based on 10 of the 13 participants, as CGM data were incomplete for 3 due to technical difficulties. Natural light exposure was also linked to metabolic changes. Participants burned more fat and fewer carbohydrates, a shift associated with better glucose control. Muscle samples suggested improved alignment of the body's internal clock or circadian rhythm, which influences how the body processes nutrients. Circadian misalignment has been linked to insulin resistance and other metabolic issues, and prior research has shown that artificial light at night can disrupt these rhythms. This study suggests that natural daylight, even indoors, may support better glucose management. The study was small and short-term, and daylight is not a substitute for standard diabetes treatments. However, researchers say increasing exposure to natural light may be a simple, no-cost way to support overall glucose management, with further research needed to confirm long-term benefits. End of article.
People with disabilities adapt on a daily basis. They're people you want on your team. And at the Mass Commission for the Blind, we're here to help you find blind and visually impaired professionals to help you reach your organizational goals. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB to learn how you can become an employer partner for the blindness community. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.